As a matter of fact, there was a review in Positif magazine, the French magazine, and they gave a very, very nice review, and they, amazingly enough, found the two major, like, literary influences and mentioned them in the review, which was wild. It was Arthur Machen, who was a British horror writer, wrote a story called The White People, a novella. That was one. And the other one was Howard Phillips Lovecraft's novella called The Shadow Over Innsmouth. And they mentioned both of them. Wow. And they were both things that I was were on my mind when I was doing it.
Wow. So.
What films influenced you to do this?
Well, we were talking before, and I mentioned Night of the Hunter. I was trying to do like a supernatural Night of the Hunter, a vampire crossed with Night of the Hunter. Also, there was another film that was a film I loved called Moonfleet. That was a Fritz Lang movie done in the early 50s in color. And Night of the Hunter is black and white, so, but the it was kind of a strange sort of a film noir, but not a film noir black and white. It was a color one, and it was all, a lot of it was shot at night, and it was, again, a child's quest through, like, unfamiliar and frightening geography and landscape.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No, 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 I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
Thank you, Michael Price, the unmistakable voice of Michael H. Price, co-author, co-creator of Stitches, the graphic novel, which is now on sale. We'll talk about that a little bit later on after the broadcast. We've been hearing from a lot of people, Michael, and we kind of cover the waterfront. A lot of people have pointed out, we kind of go from just the early talkie era all the way up, 80s, 90s stuff.
We'll sneak a silent picture in there one of these days.
Let's throw an obscure silent picture in there. But this is not that. The one we're under discussion today is Lamora, which is subtitled A Child's Tale of the Supernatural.
Yeah, an art picture that never could really find its niche.
Right.
Ended up given a proxy title, I think, called, what was it, Lady Dracula.
Yes, that's right.
Which only created confusion with a similar title from Hammer Pictures.
Right.
Countess Dracula.
Countess Dracula, yeah.
Lamora, boy, if it were. Actually, it's in about the right frame of time, 1973, to bear mentioning in the same breath with Night Tide from Curtis Harrington.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Herc Harvey's Carnival of Souls.
Mm-hmm.
And George Romero's original Night of the Living Dead.
I think so, and I think one of the things that ties all of those together, now, he was also Richard Blackman. Is that who did that? Yeah, Richard Blackman was the director, correct?
Richard Blackburn.
Mm-hmm. And I got the one that we looked at, the copy that Joey and I looked at, had an interview with him, and it was the Michael D. Moore VHS tape that was put out in the early 2000s, and had an interview with him and Art Fine and Eric Caden talking about it, and he talked about the fact that the director, Blackburn, talked about the fact that it was the success of Count Yorga that made it, relatively easy for them to find financing for the picture and find a distributor for the picture, I guess.
Makes really perfect sense.
More to the point. But it does have that very much dreamlike quality that the pictures that you cite have. And and it's also, he talked about how he was influenced by Moonfleet, Fritz Lang's picture.
Oh, yeah.
As well as Night of the Hunter.
Oh,
and I can see
wonderful stuff. And
yeah.
And Night of the Hunter dovetails with that lot that I just mentioned perfectly.
Yes, it does.
Moonfleet,
yeah.
Big picture, but a very intimate attitude about it.
Right, and of course, Fritz, one of Fritz Lang's Hollywood pictures as well.
Right. Yep.
But even the director, who later on, I think his big thing that he did in pop culture was to be involved in a production capacity, I think directing as well, Beekman's World, the science show of the 80s.
Oh, for
science
sake,
TV
yeah,
show.
And that lovely picture he did with Paul Bartel and Mary Warrenow.
Eating Raoul. Absolutely. But you know, the interesting thing, I as a Presbyterian, one of God's frozen people, well, the interesting thing that I find in this picture is the use of religion and religious symbolism.
And religious tyranny.
Absolutely. Anchored by just a closer walk with thee that Cheryl Smith sings a couple of times in the picture.
Right.
In front of an old, which we don't, I really am not clear. Joey and I were talking about this when we watched the picture. I'm really not clear why the Reverend, who is Richard Blackmon, why the Reverend, I think I'm right, doesn't the director also play the Reverend? He does, doesn't he?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And why the whole congregation are women. I've never really quite understood that lick.
I think that's for the individual viewer to interpret.
I see. Well,
another one of those pictures that is so ambiguous that it draws in the thinking viewer and repulses the viewer who wants everything spelled out.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, where the art film designation comes from, because even the director
yeah.
said in the interview, it's not really an art film and not really an exploitation film.
Correct.
But I think probably, and we don't need to go into the deeply into the plot, but essentially what it is a young lady who's essentially a ward of the preacher in this
mm-hmm.
congregation gets a letter purportedly from her father. And she goes on a quest to find him and gets involved with the title character, Lamora, played by by a woman named Leslie Gelb, and gets involved in vampirism, and there's kids involved. There's that weird sort of, not Lost Boys, but that weird sort of, what's the... not Toys in the Attic. What's that? Kids in the Attic. What's the name of that?
Oh,
Flowers
in the Attic.
Thank you. Yes. Got that
yes.
Flowers in the Attic vibe with these pale kids that you know are being, you know, being used in some horrible vampiric way, if not literally,
yeah.
then symbolically. But this is, to me, Michael, this film is all about innocence sullied. And what makes it so interesting to me, or one of the things that makes it so interesting, is the title character. Not Lamora, the title character, but the young woman, teenager.
Lila Lee. Yeah.
Lila Lee.
Cheryl Smith as the character
Smith,
named Lila Lee.
Right. Who is our viewpoint character, who was, the director tells us in the interview, a Sunset Strip denizen who was not at all the innocent that she portrays in the picture.
Makes all that better a player.
Exactly. So you've got this young girl who is anything but innocent, a very worldly young girl playing an innocent young girl being exposed to worldly weird things. And, of course, Cheryl
mm-hmm.
Smith went on and became Rainbow Smith, who was actually a pretty good, I guess you'd call her a softcore star.
Right.
And in the 70s and 80s. But it goes, it's mostly, and of course, you're from Texas, I'm from Oklahoma, so we are, and I certainly don't want to, I don't mean to be impinging, if that's the term, but I don't mean to be saying anything negative about any faith, but we in Oklahoma and Texas live generally in a Southern Baptist culture.
Okay.
And this film is imbued with that same culture.
It's very, it's like a cross between the Baptist sector and some really hardcore Roman Catholic influences.
And I would have to also add with that very classic Calvinist ideas with the idea of everything being predestined, which it seems at several junctures throughout the story, predestination sort of figures into the plot.
Big old ecclesiastical vibe going on.
Yes, there is, as well as a Song of Solomon vibe.
Yeah.
It's like when the preacher turns for Solus, who is obviously has deep-rooted designs on his young ward, flips open the Bible to try and take solace. He flips it open to the most erotic part of the entire, both Old and New Testament, when he flips open a Song of Solomon.
Oh, mercy.
It's just, it's got so much, and he never really, the interview that was on the Michael Dean Moore tape, that's the one thing he never really delved into that they never really asked him about was the strong religious milieu, I guess, in the whole book. The strong part that religion plays and the ambivalent part that religion plays, I would think, in this film as well.
Yeah, a lot of hypocrisy mixed with taboo, not just thou shalt nots, but I mean taboos.
Yes, yes.
And It's pretty spooky there.
It gets very spooky. And at the end, you talk about people who like things that are laid out for them. I still, after a couple of times watching it, I'm still not sure what's going on at the end.
And there again, the ambiguity. And it's good to compare notes, but it's never works to over explain.
Right.
Is it all in her mind?
Right.
Or is the film in attempting to be critical of religious persecution actually imposing some of that?
That's a very interesting way to look at it. You want to go get into that a little bit more?
I don't have a firm conclusion there. I think I should mention also that while we're on that topic, this film was very influential on Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He hails it very resoundingly, along with pictures like Carnival of Souls and Night Tide.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is an anti-tract.
Hmm.
That is an indictment of the kind of religion that would repress and punish in its failure to recognize and appreciate the darkness that is in every human soul.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The entire basis of organized religion is a denial of the darkness within. And it ain't all sweetness and light, folks.
See, now you're talking to a guy who wrote a novel called The Dark Within, so you're right in my wheelhouse now.
And that's a good thing to be able to criticize that. I think perhaps the film goes a bit farther than it intended or wanted to, because it seems to be, while it's ambiguous at the finale, it also seems to be drawing a conclusion for you that it didn't even attempt to do during the course of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why the all-female congregation?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Let me think about that for a while. You know, it's that sort of response. But it also leaves it open to interpretation whether this is happening in the mind of the innocent protagonist.
Mm-hmm. Who is a young lady we, I think we are made to think, is just entering puberty. and having a lot of the urges that they used to tell us about in those films that they showed us at school. and you know, there's a lot. I remember, I don't know why this came to mind, but I remember Carly Simon when she started her singing career, and of course she was from the Simon and Schuster bunch, and had all kinds of cash, and someone said to her, well, you know, you've been raised basically with a silver spoon in your mouth. How can you, have you suffered enough to be able to be a decent songwriter? And she said, or performer, and she said, anyone who's gone through adolescence has suffered enough. And I thought about that when I was watching, when I was watching this film. The other thing, if we can go back to that darkness idea, which is, you know, and I say I'm a Presbyterian, which is true, but the Presbyterian Church is a confessing church. And we know about the darkness, and we have corporate confession every week and all this kind of thing. But one of the things that there's in my novels, if anybody listening to this has read any of my fiction, I deal a lot with the spiritual in my fiction, and I did a thing called Wash in the Blood back in about 2004, a vampire televangelist novel, essentially is what it was. And I, to lead it off, I used the verse from Isaiah, which is, the light shone in the darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. I had always thought that that meant that the light of God, the light of Christ, however you want to interpret it, could not be put out by the darkness. But on the other hand, the darkness could not all be put out by the light. Mm-hmm. It took me a long time to realize that second part of it.
Well, it's a standoff. It's a perpetual standoff.
Yes.
The narrow-mindedness lies mostly in the refusal to believe in the standoff.
Right. To deny the standoff, I guess. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
To reject the idea that now this is not going to be settled anytime soon, folks.
No. We're not going to settle it on the Forgotten Horrors podcast,
oh,
I don't think.
Dear,
you.
No.
I don't think we're going to put that one to bed. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's like good versus evil. Well, what is good and what is evil?
Right.
A lot of people have opposing ideas as to what is what.
Right. That's exactly right. You know, there are people who say that they're standing up for what's right, who have that motto that is something that you may not think is right at all.
And yet, and they might be trying to suppress your inalienable rights.
Exactly.
While doing what they perceive as good. So what an existential quandary.
It is, and it almost gets, if we can throw around those kinds of words, it also gets kind of solipsistic there toward the end, I think, too.
not to mention oneric.
It does get pretty oneric toward the end. But
so, you know, I mean, hey, that's, yeah, let me grab my thesaurus here.
There's a line where Lamora says to Lila, when she's trying to turn her, I guess, says, come to my arms and free yourself of all guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a line that can be taken two different ways, certainly.
Do you come to
the light to get rid of your guilt, or do you go to the darkness to get rid of your guilt?
Man, what kind of guilt are you thinking about getting rid of?
Exactly. That's exactly right. But, you know, I've got to say, just on another, I guess on another level, that, you know, Cheryl Smith is really good in this.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. That's like, I would take her for exactly the person she portrays.
Right. Which was nothing like the person that she really was at that time before you believe Richard Blackmore. Yeah.
And so who the hell's keeping score in the first place?
Exactly.
Roddy McDowell had a funny story once about when a casting director challenged him. I think it was The Grass Harp, that Truman Capote movie.
Yes, right.
Fairly late in his life. And he was trying out for another a number of other roles at the same time. Of course, in the Grass Harp, he plays a very flamboyantly gay character.
Yes, he does.
And this casting director said, well, what makes you think you can play a straight character? And Roddy says, I'm an actor. So
there you have it.
And it's like, yeah, well, actors act, as mm-hmm. Drew Gulliger says.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what Clue said.
This Cheryl Smith, wow, what a player.
She was, and this was really her first real, I think the director said she'd done a couple of other small things or small parts, but this is the first time. She really carries the film. I mean, this is her film mm-hmm. to carry. And it is just so... I mean, I would have liked for Blackburn to have gone off a little bit into his own background, you know, because so many times when there's so much religious symbolism and so much working out of all of this religious imagery, it goes back to the bringing up of the person who's doing the film.
And, oh, I'm sure there's some autobiography in his screenplay.
Well, there's got to be. He knows it too well. He understands the very conflicts that you're talking about. He understands the guilt and the darkness and the light. And that, to me, that is what makes this picture. Well, Cheryl Smith, of course, is great, but that's what makes this picture interesting, is he really is. And when he says, and as you say, when he says it's not really an art film, but not really an exploitation film, mm-hmm. he's getting into that territory that we've talked about before. I think we talked about it with Hollywood Boulevard when we did Hollywood Boulevard on our podcast. The idea of Corman realized that you could get a certain amount of polemic, a certain amount of I guess art, for lack of a better term, or literary content, as long as you had some starlet pop or top every 10 pages of the script.
That's a worthwhile compromise.
It is, and I think that's the compromise. Although I'm not sure that the director wanted to particularly make that compromise with Lamora. I think that's a compromise that was ultimately reached. Although there's very little. There's a couple of little flashes of nudity in the picture.
I doubt he wrote it that way.
But
you know, and the guy is a tremendously accomplished music journalist as well.
Oh, I didn't know that. That same Richard Blackmer?
At the Village Voice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's who that is.
I've never met him, but I knew his work through Joel Dorn,
yes,
the former Atlantic Records executive,
yes, yes,
when Joel was running Rhino Records,
right,
and Blackburn did some of his compilations for Rhino.
Well, I knew that I'd seen his name before, and that's the same guy.
Yeah,
I had
Village
no
Voice.
Idea.
I think he was at the Village Voice around the same time my old pal Dave Hickey from Texas mm-hmm, was working for the mm-hmm. Voice. And it's like, okay, there's another guy that I want to be like when I grow up.
Right, exactly. I wonder if anybody thinks that about us, Michael, you know, now that we're growing up.
I would hesitate to ask.
I would, too. But it's something, you know, it's something to think about. I want to finally say that, to me, this is a picture, and suppose this is the art side of the equation, but this is a picture that I think you can see multiple times and really not get tired of. I've seen it two or three times over the past couple of months. And I see something, I mean, as cliche as this sounds, I do see something different in it every time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's the mark of a good, worthwhile production that doesn't have to have a Hollywood pedigree or a gigantic budget.
That's right.
In fact, I find that the ones I go back to more often are the ones that don't have that corporate baggage.
Right.
Don't have the star power,
mm-hmm.
and what they lack in star power and production values, they make up for in just plain old attitude.
That's right. Although we're not averse to enjoying those star power films. Remember, we did Female on the Beach not too long ago.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And that, which is the complete antithesis of Lamora.
Exactly.
When you really
exactly.
think about it. Yeah, yeah.
Corporate pedigree, a B movie that is a B movie that is still gigantic by comparison with this Lamora picture.
Right, right. Well, I think I could speak for you to say that we would recommend this picture to the more our more adventurous listeners, wouldn't you say?
Oh, if you're not adventurous, get that way and watch the film. You know, that's all. That's all you got to say about that.
Well, and speaking of adventurous, now I promised to have you say something about Stitches the Graphic Novel, which has just come out. What can you tell us about that?
I'm flabbergasted. Flabbergasted that we should actually be returning to a well that I thought we'd run dry in 1995. That's when the original 32-page comic book Stitches came out.
And how? Under what? Under whose auspices did that happen?
That was originally going to be a book for Malibu Graphics.
That's right. I was working for at that time. With Twilight Avenger. Sure.
Twilight Avenger, and then we did the Carnival of Souls comic book version. Well, of course, around the time we were getting ready to launch Stitches, Malibu got swallowed up and regurgitated by Marvel Comics.
Yes, it did.
Because Marvel wanted Men in Black.
Mm-hmm.
and left the dried husk of Malibu Graphics where nobody would want to touch it again.
Right.
So we ended up publishing a couple of books under our private aegis. That's Todd Camp and myself. We did the Carnival of Souls book. And left a bunch of stuff unfinished. I mean, you always do. I always bite off more than I'm prepared to chew and then go back to it time and again. But Todd called one day last year and said, "Hey, guess what I just found?" I said, "What?" He said, I found your breakdowns, your layouts for the comic book parody of Jurassic Park." I said, "Well, oh, great. I'd almost forgotten about it. Let's finish it." So we ended up getting that thing put back together. It didn't make the cut for this first new Stitches, but it'll be in a second volume.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we had the original 32-page book to reprint, and we had a bunch of new stuff, a little bit of comics from the Gone World series. And I found the entire partial... That's a contradiction in terms.
Right.
Found all
it's an oxymoron,
that there was.
Isn't it? Yeah.
We found all that there was to find of a false start that Todd Camp had made toward a book about George Bush's malapropisms.
Oh.
To have been written by a scholarly historian named Dr. Paul Bowler with cartoons by Todd.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, well, Dr. Bowler died at a rather advanced age a couple of years ago. The book was a false start. It got begun but never finished. I said, okay, send me those cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's get them on the flatbed scanner and go to town with them. So we've got the, and it's an anthology, a couple of stories that Josh Friedman and I did, mm-hmm. Josh Allen Friedman.
He's in a wonderful new album, too, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Boy.
That guy knows no limits. And,
he does.
Josh and I had wanted to do a book about the Elevator Men of New York characters mm-hmm. in some of the early Friedman Brothers stories. And we got as far as two stories. Here we could bite off more than you can chew, but those were finished. And, and it's like, okay, what are these doing in the flat files? Why aren't they in print?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of our stuff, yours and mine both, and certainly Todd Camp's and mine, a lot of our stuff that gets published comes about after we stumble across it and says, why the hell isn't this in print?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Hence, Stitches, the Graphic Novel.
And it's available.
That's a big old belly button of a comic book.
Yes.
What, 200 pages? It just landed on Amazon about a week ago.
Okay. So folks can order it from Amazon or from the, I guess, CreateSpace store. Can they do that as well?
They can, but for most of our listeners, it's most convenient to go straight to Amazon.
Yeah. And I'd say the same thing. You know, we've got the holidays coming up. I'd say the same thing for my books as well. And I'll plug a couple of them. We have a perennial John McMahon and I, my partner John McMahon, in in Reverse Karma Press. We have a kind of a perennial book that starts selling again about this time of the year every year, which is called Hardboiled Christmas Stories.
That's
on dinner. Yeah, thank you. It's on Amazon, and it's reprints from the pulps, hard-boiled detective stories from the pulp magazines of the 30s and 40s with Christmas themes. And I wrote a new story of Dan Turner, Hollywood detective, in the style of Dan's creator, Robert Leslie Bellum. And so that's out there. I would like to also, I'm very happy to be able to say that a book that I co-wrote was a top pick on Amazon. It was the number one for about 3 or 4 weeks, the number one new baseball biography release on Amazon. It's called Right Down the Middle, the Ralph Terry story. Wrote it with a guy from my hometown named Ralph Terry, who was the top right-handed pitcher on those early New York Yankees teams, the early 60s New York Yankees teams. He decided it was time for him to tell his story. Only guy to pitch the last pitch in two World Series Game 7s. And so that's out there on Amazon, as well as the perennial favorite. At least it's one of my favorites. I'm not sure it's anybody else's by the looks of the sales figures. But it's called Homicide Highball, which is the original script I did for the Dan Turner Hollywood Detective movie back in 1990. Anything else that you would like to plug that's out there too? These, you know, we're thinking about Christmas now, and these books make wonderful gifts.
Oh yeah. We don't know when to stop,
and so
we probably ought to stop and go back and make some more stuff so we can clutter the market further.
Well, we've got a couple of ideas, don't we?
Yes, we do,
uh-huh.
and we'll get into that in greater detail as things develop. But old Santa Claus is coming, and he could do a great deal worse than Homicide Highball or Stitches.
Exactly, I'm with you all the way, Michael. And listen, we actually the next time around we're going to have something. I don't want to say exactly what it is, but we're going to have something that our producer Joey Hambrick suggested that we do, and it's kind of a double feature. And Joey says if we did this, it would be the weirdest Forgotten Horrors podcast we've ever done. We've been doing these damn things for what, a couple years now, Joey?
You mean even weirder than Orgy of the Dead?
Even weirder than Orgy of the Dead. It'll make Orgy of the Dead look like The Outsiders. No, I don't think anything could do that, but that was just the first thing that came to mind.
Well, yeah.
But this will be a twofer. This will be a kind of a double feature that we'll be doing next, and that's kind of all we want to say about that. But we want to say thanks. Well, I know we've been hearing from people. God bless them that have been listening to the podcast. We've been getting hundreds and hundreds of listeners to each one, and we just really do appreciate that.
A lot of Facebook responses, and by the way, those who follow the podcast, there is a Facebook page, and we welcome you there.
Yes.
And you're certainly welcome to pull up John Woolley's or my Facebook pages and just, you know, lavish all your condemnations upon both of us.
That's right. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should say that Joey runs my Facebook pages. And Joey Hambrick runs my Facebook pages. I also have a website, and we work on that as well. So, Michael, we'll be back probably pretty close to the Yuletide season with some more fun. And I always enjoy visiting, and I hope the folks enjoyed listening to what we had to say about Lamora tonight.
That's what we do.
That's indeed what we do. Talk to you soon.